Questions sur vos droits? Votre comité logement peut vous aider. Pour trouver le comité logement pour votre quartier ou pour plus de ressources, visitez le www.rclalq.qc.ca.
Gentlemen, friends, and comrades, to this edition of Amanda Radio here at CKUT 90.3 in Montreal. We're a weekly news show with the news, analysis, and briefings on the continent of Africa. This week we have a tremendous interview. Gwen got in touch with Andy Currier from the Oakland Institute, and they did a brilliant interview. The Oakland Institute is a think tank for progressives. It takes on land rights, equity, sustainable food systems, international aid, climate change, challenges the World Bank group, and looks at food systems and so on. And they have done a report called The Looming Threat of Eviction, the Continued Displacement of the Maasai Under the Guise of Conservation in Ngorongoro Conservation Area. And Andy Currier talks with Gwen about that. I've got a reading that I'm going to do from Canadian Dimension for the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute, which has put together a modest proposal for reimagining Canadian foreign policy that would bring Canada back into the modern world and take us out of the grips of profiteers in the business world. And finally, two short clips, one from Al Jazeera's Nicholas Hack about the coup that occurred in Guinea last week. And at the end of April, Hissène Habré died in prison, not lamented by very many people, serving time for crimes he committed against humanity, torture, brutal repression of his country in the 1980s. So that's a report from Deutsche Welle. Stay tuned to Amandla.
Andy Currier is a research associate at the Oakland Institute and recently co-authored the report, The Looming Threat of Eviction, the Continued Displacement of the Maasai Under the Guise of the Conservation in the Ngorongoro Conservation Area. Andy, welcome to Amandla.
Thanks for having me.
So what the Maasai right now are facing the latest chapter in a long continuum of dispossession that dates back to the colonial period. And while we're certainly going to focus on what's going on right now, could you start just by taking us back and giving us some historical context?
Of course. And I think that's really important to understand what's happening now, is to go back and see, the cycle of broken promises that have continually dispossessed the Maasai. So the Maasai have inhabited the Great Rift Valley of East Africa for centuries, moving their herds of cattle with the seasons. And they're regarded as the first cattlemen, really admired for how they've managed their herds and the relationships they've had with wildlife and the grasslands that support them. However, the colonial rulers, and after independence, the Tanzanian government, have failed to understand this symbiotic relationship that the Maasai have with the land. So consequently, you see conservation schemes, game parks, and development strategies that have been aimed at attracting foreign investors and tourists have been driving them from their ancestral land.
Okay, before we get to that, let's just back up, because certainly during the colonial period, the Maasai already had to contend with very extensive land dispossession. So before we even get to the role of conservation agencies, and I know they were already coming in the colonial period, but what was the experience of the Maasai in terms of their struggle to maintain their way of life and their economy?
Yeah, so the report, The Looming Threat of Eviction, it has a full timeline that kind of gets into each step and each restriction that has been imposed on them over time. But there's one kind of critical point that I wanted to make sure that was understood. And this is during the creation of Serengeti National Park in 1957. So the Maasai were persuaded to leave their ancestral land, which was today where Serengeti National Park is. And they were given what is now the Ngorongoro Conservation Area under the premise that it would be a multiple land use area for them to share with wildlife. And, you know, it was explicitly noted at the time that it was the intention of the government to develop the area in the interests of the people. And it was supposed to be clear that if there's any conflict between the interests of the Maasai and the animals, the interests of the Maasai would take precedence. So it was with this promise that they agreed to relocate to what is now the NCA, where over time their authority over decision-making has been reduced and they've seen more livelihood restrictions imposed onto them.
Could you give us some example of those restrictions and how they have impacted their lifestyle and, well, I guess not really lifestyle, their economy, their organization?
Right. So the way that they, the pastoralist practices they have where they graze cattle in a way that's, you know, it's made Ngorongoro Conservation Area the ecological hotspot and wildlife kind of the reason it's such an important place through the conservation lens today is because of their practices. So when some people hear of cattle grazing, they might not think of it as the most sustainable practice, you know, in the Western, you know, the way we're doing it here in North America. This is very different. And the way that they would rotate where their cattle would graze, so that was restricted. They were prevented from accessing certain areas that supplied nutrients and water for cattle. So that was the first thing that, you know, had a huge impact on their way of life. The other thing was after when livestock where cattle could graze was restricted, they turned to small subsistence gardens, little home gardens, not large scale agriculture by any means. And over time, even this was banned. So they were prevented from even having small subsistence gardens, which has had a terrible impact on food security for Maasai communities.
So to what extent is there still a pastoralist economy in that area?
As much as there can be now, it's not, you know, the way that they've traditionally practiced it has been greatly constrained, and that in and of itself has negatively impacted it, but it is still their way of life, and it is still, you know, the interests of Maasai communities to live this way, and something they've proven they can do sustainably if they're allowed to use their traditional knowledge, and that's been gained through centuries of experience.
Yeah, if they're allowed, which I guess are really key words, because I'd like to kind of move it to the present right now. The Tanzanian government now wants to rezone the Ngorongoro Conservation Area to create what it calls a multiple land use model, or an MLUM. And in your report, you quote Maasai elders as stating that the MLUM will mark the end of the Maasai community in the famous World Heritage Site. So what is the MLUM exactly, and what are its implications for the Maasai?
So the MLUM is a new, it's a proposed plan. It's a four-zone management plan that further restricts areas that Maasai can access for grazing livestock and even where they can live. So it, in total, it actually expands the total size of the area, but reduces the land that Maasai can access. And so to restructure the NCA under this plan, there's an accompanying proposed resettlement for villages within the NCA that's been developed to relocate up to 82,000 residents, including the vast majority of indigenous pastoralists. And
why is the government doing this? Why continuously restrict the Maasai to smaller and smaller patches of land? What is it that they want to do with this land?
So there's a number of myths that have been promoting, have been pushing this plan. One of them is rising population of the Maasai is having a negative impact on the ecology of the area, which we break down that argument. And I'm happy to go into more detail. The other factor that we are quite frank about is the tourism motivations. So how expanding tourism and revenues from tourism is really driving this plan. So, you know, tourism in the area has exploded in recent years. The number of annual tourists rose from 20,000 in 1979 to over 644,000 in 2017, 2018. So this is one of the most intensively visited conservation areas in Africa. You have a high number of vehicles entering the Gorongoro crater every day. And so the result of this has been tourism has become a very significant economic resource for Tanzania. 2019, it generated over $2.6 billion. And the MLUM plan explicitly mentions the financial stakes here. And it's directly in the plan that maintaining the status quo or leaving the NCA to indigenous pastoralists, the government would lose 50% of expected revenues by 2038. So really by limiting settlements and areas that residents can access, you have areas, you know, of this false sort of wild Africa for tourism expand. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you have buses full of tourists continue to come into the NCA, and the environmental threat this poses is not really being looked at. Well, most restrictions are instead targeting local residents.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's take a little bit of a devil's advocate approach here. Some would say, look, it's the 21st century. Tourism is the industry that will provide most people with the best livelihoods in Tanzania. Pastoralism and small-scale agriculture benefit a relative few and are a thing of the past. What's your response to that?
So I think, looking at who tourism benefits here, the Maasai are not seeing revenues from tourism. The Maasai also, they're not against tourism altogether. It's just the sort of reality of you have Western tourists don't want to see Maasai. It's sort of this strange dichotomy where they want to see Maasai and take some pictures, see some colorful beads, see the traditional housing, and, you know, maybe take a picture just to show that they met someone in a famous tribe. But when Maasai want to graze their cattle, something they've done, you know, for centuries, this doesn't fit the vision that tourists have. And so they don't want to see it. And then the result is that the government restricts that. So I think really looking at who tourism benefits, you have foreign investors who are benefiting at a far greater rate than the Maasai who aren't seeing the material benefits from this. So that's really the pushback on tourism is benefiting the Maasai. It's not as of this point at all.
Okay. Earlier on, you touched on, and I really do want to dive into this now, the role of conservation agencies in this whole dynamic. And in there, I include as well UNESCO. In your report, you state that UNESCO has gone as far as to advocate for the complete removal of all people to create a nature reserve while keeping the bomas or the traditional Maasai housing compounds intact for cultural tourism, something you also just alluded to. Can you talk to us a little bit more about the relationship between these agencies and indigenous populations? Because on the face of it, UNESCO, of all organizations, which is supposed to protect and promote culture and cultural diversity, is in there advocating for the dispossession of indigenous people from their land.
Yeah, and just for a little context and how they've been involved with this new plan. But so the NCA was added to the UNESCO World Heritage Site list for its natural characteristics back in 1979, and then again for its cultural values in 2010. It's important to note, though, for both designations, the Maasai residents were not adequately consulted, you know, if they wanted this to become a World Heritage Site. And this is really consequential because, as I've said, and there's just been so many additional restrictions that have come with this listing. But so this legacy of international conservation agencies displacing and constricting Maasai livelihoods, it really continues with this current plan. So in 2019, there was a joint monitoring mission from the UNESCO World Heritage Center, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, IUCN, and the International Council on Monuments and Sites, ICOMOS, which called on the Ngorongoro Conservation Area Authority and the Tanzanian government to urgently implement policies to control population growth. So this came from the monitoring mission report. And drawing from this list of recommendations, the Tanzanian government produced this new plan. As you mentioned, you know, the role that the Tanzanian National UNESCO Commission had in, you know, talking about completely removing people, this was an even more extreme plan than the Tanzanian government actually ended up implementing. And, you know, seeing this complicity of the UNESCO World Heritage Center in guiding this plan, it's really in violation of covenants of the United Nations pertaining to human rights, and it runs counter to UNESCO's own constitution. So, you know, allowing indigenous rights to be violated in the name of conservation demonstrates just a blatant disregard for the historical wrongs inflicted upon the Maasai, the international rights of indigenous people, and the fact that protection of human rights is essential for conserving nature, which is something that they, of all groups, should really understand.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you had indicated, you know, these big game parks and all of the tourism that goes around that is a lot less environmentally sustainable than a pastoralist economic model. Why do you think, I mean, how do we explain UNESCO's approach here? Is it, I mean, it sounds very colonial.
It is, and you know, it's really, it's, while this report focuses on the plight of the Maasai in Tanzania, it's a reality that's all too familiar for indigenous communities around the world. And so UNESCO is kind of a part of this, these driving forces pushing for what's called fortress conservation, which, like you mentioned, very much rooted in a colonial attitude that people need to be removed from the environment in order to protect it, which is, you know, frankly not the case with how long Maasai have lived there, how sustainably their lifestyles and livelihoods have you know, really benefited the area. This is just being ignored and saying it needs to just be this nature-only area in order to be protected.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess this would be an opportune time to point out that both in your country and mine, the United States and Canada, we have a national park system that is very much rooted in dispossession of indigenous communities in order to create these parks. So it's, you know, there's a definite parallel.
Right. And it's scary to see that being used as a model for countries in Africa to follow, where, you know, if you're taking the treatment of indigenous populations by the U.S. and Canada as your model, you're really headed down a dark path, and something that Tanzania can still avoid, but it really is a crucial moment here.
So it occurred to me when I was preparing this interview, I do a lot of interviewing around land dispossession at the hands of mining companies, in particular Canadian mining companies. And Tanzania is certainly a country that has had a lot of experience with Canadian mining companies. And when communities try to mobilize in resistance, it's very difficult and very challenging. But it's rare that they really have to convince people that mining companies are not great forces for progressive change. And people are pretty clear that mining companies are in there for profit, and they will put their shareholders before anybody else. And so that argument is kind of already in the bag when communities are mobilizing. It seems to me this is different. When you're talking about conservation agencies, UNESCO, I think in the popular imagination, what people think of is protecting ecosystems, flora and fauna, and all of that. And there's a relatively positive, in the imagination, positive association. So how difficult do you think that is making it for the Maasai to resist what's going on and to mobilize international support for their struggle?
I think it's a good question, and I think a lot of people, like you mentioned, would have a fairly positive view of what UNESCO is doing. And one group of people who would not share that view are the Maasai, who have been directly, you know, working or being on the receiving end of their policies for the last several decades. You know, the role UNESCO plays here is clearly understood by the Maasai. And what's particularly concerning here is they are consulting. You are seeing consultations with Indigenous groups, and you know, they've been recorded. There's a list of demands from, I think it was the early 2000s, that closely mirrors the demands that Maasai communities have today. And they've been understood by UNESCO and different conservation agencies, and they've just been ignored. They haven't been implemented into the final plan. So for the Maasai, the role that UNESCO is playing here is far from positive. And you see a push now with Indigenous residents, you know, who are at the end of what they can take in terms of restrictions, who advocate for the delisting of Ngorongoro as a protected, as a World Heritage Site, if their rights cannot be respected.
What kind of support do the Maasai enjoy among Tanzanians in general in this struggle?
It's hard for me to say fully. I mean, we've seen putting this out and promoting it. We've heard from people just on social media, different Tanzanian groups and different individuals who really have bought some of the myths that are being pushed to evict the Maasai, and saying, you know, this is time. They need to modernize and move on, and kind of some really misguided perceptions that show how successful this myth that their population growth has had a negative impact on the area, and that, you know, they're putting the NCA in this terrible spot. Because it's also worth noting, and I didn't touch on it earlier, but I'd like to just briefly, but the restrictions on the Maasai are not just hurting the Maasai, they're also negatively impacting the ecosystem they're supposedly in place to protect. And so, you know, the knowledge of the Maasai has been largely credited as allowing the large mammal population and ecological diversity to grow in Ngorongoro. And, you know, while the health of animal populations is not in an urgent state of decline, you see the government and international conservation agencies talk about range degradation and an increase in alien species as evidence that the area is suffering. This really ignores, though, how restrictions placed on traditional practices have been responsible for these conditions. One quick example is just fire. So fire is a crucial conservation tool used by the Maasai for centuries to manage the savanna landscape. So the periodic burning of grasses removes some ticks and other pests that threaten both cattle and wildlife. And at the same time, it spurs the growth of new grass that allows both wildlife and livestock to thrive. But so you've seen, though, once pastoralists have been restricted from certain areas and unable to do their periodic burning, the evidence has shown that the absence of fire has allowed scrub, woodland, invasive species to take over. And this has had a negative impact on the wild animals themselves. So, and also reduced plant diversity. So, you know, while you see these myths being pushed on the Tanzanian population, and you know, we've seen, actually, it's been cool to see some initially support the relocation of the Maasai until they read the report and kind of taken a step back and said, oh, that actually doesn't sound like a good idea at all. And so I think it's hard to say for me how much the Tanzanian government or the Tanzanian population supports it. Generally, it's just, I think there's just a lot of misinformation guiding those who are going along with this.
You've alluded a few times now to the purported overpopulation of the area, and this reference to immigrant populations that have moved in over the decades. So can you please speak to that? What is it that the government is arguing, and what's the counter argument to that?
Yeah, so out of the 82,000 mostly Maasai pastoralists to be relocated under the plan, the resettlement plan claims that there are 40,000 immigrants, quote unquote immigrants, who will be identified and moved back to their place of origin by the end of this year, actually. So that looks extremely unlikely at this point. But the identification of migrant households has already started in several villages. What you've seen, though, is people who have lived in the NCA for generations were added to these lists. And given the absence of documentation, it's impossible for many Indigenous to prove they're descended from the original inhabitants of the area. And it's very possible they're going to be relocated under this pretense. So I think Indigenous communities do recognize there are some immigrants and support their relocation. It's just the way that this is being done, very top down, not giving them any sort of authority over the process. It really scares them, rightfully so, in that they're going to be removed under this pretense.
Is there any evidence that, it's just to go back to the parallel with mining companies, so very often when mining companies or oil companies come in, they will try to systematically co-opt leadership in an effort to try to divide the community and reduce resistance or organization against their activities. Is there any evidence that that's been going on?
No, I mean, there's been one interesting case here where you've had, there was a group of people to review and kind of consult with the initial plan of villages to be removed. And several Maasai were involved on that committee. However, after being a part of it in the beginning, they really expressed their reservations with the decisions being made and really tried to push back on, you know, why is this village being marked for being abandoned when it doesn't actually, the area it's in is not a, you know, ecologically sensitive spot and people can remain living here. They pushed back very firmly on that, were ignored ultimately in development of the plan, and actually broke free and wrote a dissenting position, kind of voicing their concerns, showing that they were being ignored. So I think in that case, you don't have leaders being co-opted, and actually, you know, making a point out of this, that they're not being given power, and the result is going to be disastrous for their communities.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's look at what the Maasai are doing about this. They have, yes, a very long experience with dispossession, racism, and through that whole time, they have accommodated in some instances, they have resisted in others, a combination of both. What's going on now? How would you describe the response and the strategy to this very imminent threat to them?
So you've seen a few different strategies being used, and I think just to first note to really understand how they're struggling and how they're resisting, the circumstances they're facing are incredibly dire. Given the restrictions I've already mentioned, there's a fact-finding mission earlier this year, which collected quotes from some residents, and they really just give a sense of how dire this is. You know, people saying we are permanently starving because of bad policies. Some women have died of hunger, and one even going as far as to say it is genocide against Ngorongoro pastoralists. And you've seen them resist despite, you know, how difficult the situation is. One avenue for Maasai has been legal action. So following violent government-led evictions of Maasai villagers in Loliondo from their legally registered land in 2017, and these evictions damaged thousands of homes and left 20,000 homeless, four Maasai villages brought a case against the government in the Regional East African Court of Justice. And now in September of 2018, they won a major victory, actually, as the court granted an injunction prohibiting the government from evicting communities and destroying homesteads, which was a great victory for that area. However, it doesn't protect the whole, you know, all of the communities in the NCA today, unfortunately. So one of the other strategies you've seen is mass mobilization. This April, eviction notices for alleged immigrants living in the NCA and demolition notices for schools, hospitals, and other community buildings were published by the Ngorongoro Conservation Area Authority. And there was immediate and widespread outrage from the residents. They came together, organized a press conference to really amplify their concerns. And the result was that the NCA authority actually suspended the relocation and demolition orders until further notice. So despite this pause, though, the threat of relocation does remain. They haven't been permanently canceled. And the way these just kind of sprung up out of nowhere, it's very possible it could happen again. But I think, you know, again, all this resistance is made even more courageous when the political climate of Tanzania is understood. Recent years, there's been growing authoritarianism and the intolerance of dissent in the country. So our partners who stepped forward and shared the concerns for the impact of these plans, of the MLUM and resettlement plan, they're taking a great risk to their personal safety. But it is because of this courage that the international community is now aware of what is happening.
All right, so for our listeners who A, would like to learn more about this, and B, perhaps even get involved, what would be your suggestion?
Yeah, so I would recommend anyone first who wanted to learn more in more detail, The Oakland Institute has published two reports on the Maasai in Tanzania. The first was 2018 on Losing the Serengeti, which focuses a bit more on the role of foreign investors and tourism companies. Then just this year, we released The Looming Threat of Eviction, which is available at oaklandinstitute.org. So I would recommend anyone read that. So we've shared the findings from these reports with the international conservation groups, and who have not taken action at this point. Or
Have any of them responded?
Yeah, we've had a dialogue, and you know, they haven't taken action, or they've really tried to distance themselves from the actions of the Tanzanian government. So with this kind of initial hesitancy to take action, we, alongside Rainforest Rescue, launched a petition which amplifies a list of community demands to the World Heritage Center and the Tanzanian government. And so far, this petition has nearly 100,000 signatures. And so I would invite listeners to go and sign it. You can find it on our website, as well as Rainforest Rescue's. And they can add their names to this petition that really amplifies the demands of communities and brings them to the forefront. So we're hopeful with, you know, with international pressure, given how influential UNESCO has been on the development of this current plan, we're hopeful they can be pushed to direct the Tanzanian government towards respecting the rights and needs of local communities. The good news I will say, though, is that this plan that we've publicized and have drawn international attention to, it has not been officially implemented yet. Mm-hmm. And so what we've seen in the past is that these plans will be made, they'll be made and they'll move forward behind closed doors until they're implemented, really before the public becomes fully aware of them. In this case, we have now amplified this issue globally, and we'll continue to monitor it as it unfolds.
Okay, maybe it's a final question. Do the Maasai, have they put forth an alternate vision of how to move forward? They're under enormous pressure, and let's face it, the tourism industry, which is largely foreign owned and controlled, is an extremely powerful lobby. So they're up against a lot. They have a government that, as you pointed out, does not represent them and uses repression over negotiation. So, you know, are they coming up with an alternate vision that could perhaps put them at the table in a way that will serve them well?
Yeah. So, and these demands and this way forward is clearly expressed in the petition, and really beyond permanently canceling the eviction notices that I mentioned from April, and lifting the restrictions that are driving the current hunger crisis. Communities are really calling for the creation of an independent and participatory commission made up of experts in ecology and wildlife, human rights activists, and local residents in an equal ratio, tasked to go through all challenges and recommend the best way forward to create the plan that ensures that the area's ecology, wildlife, and pastoral livelihoods can coexist. And at the end of the day, that's really what they're asking for, is for the ability to represent their communities and be involved in this decision making, not just consulted and then ignored, but empowered in future management decisions.
Great place to end. Thank you so much, Andy. The really great interview, and we'll continue to follow this.
Great. Thank you so much. Really appreciate you taking the time to amplify this struggle.
The Canadian Foreign Policy Institute has been established here in Montreal, and its director is Bianca Mugheni, well known to people as an activist, an environmental activist initially or more largely, and now a broader mandate. And to my great pleasure. They published in the most recent copy of Canadian Dimension on 1st of September this year a policy, a foreign policy platform that could be adopted by all. It's called a progressive, a modest proposal for reimagining Canadian foreign policy. I tried to get through to somebody from the Institute, but they couldn't get back to me in time. And given the elections coming up, I thought I would just read the thing in its entirety to you. So here it is, a modest proposal for reimagining Canadian foreign policy, a cost-free foreign policy platform most progressive voters could endorse, by Bianca Mugheni. Kim Campbell once said, an election is no time to discuss serious issues. While most politicians would reject the former prime minister's bluntness, they largely follow her logic, offering sound bites and snappy proposals and rather than substantial policy reforms. Recognizing the often rigid parameters of electioneering, the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute has developed a concise, practical, and cost-free foreign policy platform we believe most progressive voters could endorse. First, cancel the Canadian Commercial Corporation's multi-billion-dollar light armored vehicle contract with Saudi Arabia. Canada shouldn't be arming one of the most repressive nations on earth, which is responsible for incredible suffering in Yemen. Two, strengthen regulations on arm exports to bring Canadian legislation into full compliance with the Arms Trade Treaty. Three, withdraw from the Lima Group of nations seeking to oust Venezuela's government. Instigated by Canada and Peru 4 years ago, the Lima Group has lost many of its founding members recently. Four, release Meng Wanzhou as part of negotiations to return Michael Spavor and Michael Kovrig. Canada should have ignored Donald Trump's extradition request. Five, halt Canadian naval participation in provocative U.S.-led missions in the South China Sea. Six, aggressively support a World Trade Organization patent waiver for COVID-19 vaccines. Seven, permit Canada's BioLease Pharma to fulfill its contract with Bolivia to produce COVID-19 vaccines if the patent waiver is granted. Eight, sign the United Nations Nuclear Ban Treaty. The Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons entered into force in January, and 97 countries have already signed on to this effort to criminalize nuclear weapons. 9. Give the Canadian Ombudsman for Responsible Enterprise full power to investigate and withdraw public support from Canadian mining companies found to be responsible for significant abuses abroad. 10. Place a moratorium on negotiating foreign investment promotion and protection agreements which grant corporations special powers to sue governments for lost profits in international tribunals. 11. Withdraw from the core group that heavily shapes Haitian affairs. Canada should not be part of an alliance of international ambassadors dictating to Haitians. 12. Withdraw Canadian troops from Russia's border in Ukraine and Latvia. 13. Restart diplomatic relations with Iran, severed by the Stephen Harper government. 14. Withdraw Canada's armed forces from Iraq. It's not in Canada's interest to be involved in a proxy conflict with Iran. 15. Retract Canadian opposition to the International Criminal Court's investigation of Israeli war crimes. 16. Apply the Foreign Enlistment Act to groups recruiting for the Israeli military in Canada. 17. Ask the Canadian Revenue Agency to investigate registered charities violating its rules by supporting the Israeli military, racist organizations, and the West Bank settlements. 18. Call for an end to the exemption for military's greenhouse gas emissions in the upcoming COP26 climate negotiations. Stop exempting the Department of National Defense from government greenhouse gas reduction targets. 19. Scrap the plan to spend up to $5 billion on armed drones. And finally, the most important in my view is 20, place a moratorium on purchasing new fighter jets. The $19 billion to $77 billion over their life cycle set aside for the planned purchase of the new fighter jets should be redesignated towards a just transition away from fossil fuels. None of these 20 points are particularly radical. None require significant new resources. Many will save taxpayers significant sums. What's more, the plan doesn't require Canada to withdraw from its international alliances or free trade accords, and it aligns with the United Nations Charter. These proposals are also consistent with the government's claim to support a rules-based international order and feminist foreign policy. Implementing these proposals will put us on the path towards a more just foreign policy, increase Canada's standing in the global community, and rehabilitate our international reputation after losing a high-profile bid for one of the rotating seats on the United Nations Security Council last year. Ahead of the next federal election, candidates from all parties should be asked if they support these modest proposals. This has been written by Bianca Mugheni, an author, activist, and director of the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute based here in Montreal. It's a very easy find. If you go to foreignpolicy1word.ca, it'll go straight there. And the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute informs people about countries' diplomatic aid, intelligence, and military process abroad. The Canadian Foreign Policy Institute opposes the racism embedded in Canadian foreign policy. The nonpartisan organization also monitors corporate Canada's international activities. While Canadians generally believe their country is benevolent for us internationally, the facts often suggest otherwise. The Canadian Foreign Policy Institute seeks to bridge the gap between government policy and public perception. The election's coming up. As most of you know, I don't have much time for elections, so I'm not going to be spending a lot of time on that. But these are demands that are universal, sustainable, equitable, and that see a readjustment of foreign policy in the interests of human and social justice as compared to corporate profit. So I encourage you to go to the website, foreignpolicy.ca, read their materials, get involved in their institute. It's a good way to support a progressive change. Well, that's to follow that up. We've seen once again problems in West Africa with the coup. Soldiers under the leader, French Foreign Legion, now Army General in who have led a coup against the Guinea President Alpha Condé. There was a widely disputed election last October when Condé went for a third presidential term, and in a thoroughly corrupt and fixed election won it. And there's been a lot of dissent in the country, a lot of unhappiness. What I've got is an Al Jazeera report from the 6th of September talking and giving some background about the coup. And while it very controversial, and nonetheless, everybody has condemned it so far, and we'll try and get somebody on next week to help us understand more fully what that, but here the Al Jazeera report will give you a first in background. And then the other report I have is a Deutsche Welle report of the former brutal dictator of Chad, Hissène Habré, has died of COVID-19 as a prisoner, serving time for his war crimes, crimes against humanity, and torture. Under his rule in Chad, Habré enforced a brutal crackdown of dissent with tens of thousands of people killed. He ruled with an iron fist for 8 years in the 1980s. It was a French and CIA-backed coup that took him to power. When he was overthrown and chased out, there were new people who had taken over the Debré's, and now Debré's son have not changed anything. So we'll get more background on that for you for next week so that we can understand what's been going on.
Oh, be real. Come on, baby, come here. Not in his usual presidential attire. On this mobile phone video, the 83-year-old president appears disheveled. He's being detained by the country's special forces. Men meant to protect him now hold him in custody. One soldier asks him, "Have you been beaten or injured?" "No," he says. On national television, coup leader Mamadi Doumbouya, a former French legionnaire, now head of the country's special forces, says the borders are closed and the constitution dissolved. Condé has been deposed.
The personalization of politics, of political life, is over. We will no longer entrust politics to a man. We will entrust it to the people. We come only for that. It is the duty of a soldier to save the country. The only thing that motivates us is that we are going to put in place a system that does not exist, and we must all build this system together.
There were celebrations in some neighborhoods of the capital before an overnight nationwide curfew was put in place, with the military patrolling the streets. Coup leaders have removed regional governors and replaced them with military commanders. The military has asked civil servants to return to work on Monday, and all former ministers and government officials are expected to gather at 11 a.m. at the People's Palace. The coup leaders say any defiance will be treated as an act of rebellion. Earlier, gunfire and explosions were heard around the presidential palace, with men in uniform asking residents to stay indoors. Alpha Condé won last October's presidential election. Amidst widespread protest, he amended the constitution, allowing him to run for a third mandate. The outcome was disputed by the opposition and members of civil society. Security forces fired live rounds to disperse the demonstrators. French President Macron accused Condé of grabbing power, with neighboring Senegal and Guinea-Bissau closing their borders, leaving the president increasingly isolated. Condé has been accused by critics of corruption and profiting from the mineral-rich country while leaving the citizens in poverty. Last week, Alpha Condé asked the parliament to raise the budget for the president while reducing budgets and wages of the civil servants and members of the security forces, stirring further discontent, especially among the ranks of the armed forces.
Clearly, the security forces, they are divided, as this has been pointed out, but they are the one leading the game right now. And Some people are wondering if there are some opposition leader in the background. It's too early to say that.
The United Nations Secretary General has called for the immediate release of the president and condemned the takeover by security forces. The African Union and ECOWAS have also condemned the coup, with the West African bloc threatening sanctions if the elected government isn't reinstated. After 11 years in power and thwarting numerous coup attempts, Alpha Condé appears meek and humiliated, no longer in power, in a country in chaos, faced with uncertainty. Nicholas Hawke, Al Jazeera.
Well, Ghanaian journalist Yusuf Ba sent us this update from Conakry.
Up till now, the president is in the hands of the special force. They've confirmed it, and they said the president is safe, and nothing is going to happen with the president. And they've asked all Guineans to go to work tomorrow, and they've asked all government authorities to report tomorrow at the parliament building. Anybody who refuses to go, they will take that person, they'll call that person a rebel, and this person will be arrested. Just now, military officials were telling us, talking to we, the journalists, around the national television tonight, although we have the curfew, they said to us, Yusuf, this coup is not a military coup. This is for the people. We are here to free the people. We are here. The people of Guinea have been suffering, so they're asking all Guineans to support them. He said it's like they are getting the support from the general public. Everybody is in line with the coup leaders. Everybody, up to now, already there is coffee, but there are some areas, people are in the streets, still dancing, welcoming the military. And there is no military patrol in the streets. Nobody's patrolling the streets. They've asked everybody to go to work tomorrow. So if people go to work tomorrow, definitely 100% the military have succeeded. Everybody is in support of them. There came a time when Guineans were asking for change. Most of the Guineans were asking for change. So this is exactly what is happening.
Well, the UN Secretary General has tweeted about the coup in Guinea, saying, I'm personally following the situation there very closely. I strongly condemn any takeover of the government by force of the gun and call for the immediate release of President Alpha Condé. Okwasi-Ose is a professor of history and political science at Delaware University. He says citizens are backing Colonel Dumbuya.
Don't forget, Colonel Dumbuya is a Condé man. He was placed in charge of the special forces and specially trained to protect Condé. So I think it's important to understand why perhaps the country seems to stand behind him, because he is considered a Condé person. And if he believes that this is what they need to do, then perhaps that's why they're following him. So all sources say that in spite of the AU, ECOWAS requests for them to go back to the barracks, it's not working. It's not being heard in Guinea. And the people are behind Colonel Dumbuya. We just have to look next door to Mali to find out what happened in Mali and Cote d'Ivoire, for example. We're talking about situations where sitting presidents force their way into unconstitutional third terms. And we know what happened in Mali. We still have the military in control. They're still discussing what to do next in Mali. I believe that is precisely what's going to happen in Guinea. It's, you know, right now, there's no question that Colonel Dumbuya is in charge, and he's the de facto head. So sanctions or no sanctions, they would have to talk to him. And more importantly, they would have to take the measure of the country. And it is clear that it is a popular uprising, at least as of the moment.
Chad's former president, Hissein Habré, has died aged 79 after testing positive for COVID-19. He was serving a life sentence in Senegal for war crimes, crimes against humanity and torture. Under his rule, Habré enforced a brutal crackdown on dissent, where tens of thousands of people were killed.
Africa's Pinochet, Hissein Habré earned his nickname as he ruled Chad with an iron fist for 8 years in the 1980s. Cunning and charismatic, Chad's former dictator seized power in a CIA-backed coup in 1982. His paranoid and brutal regime was supported by France and the United States and based on ruthless repression. His secret police killed as many as 40,000 Chadians and kidnapped, tortured, or raped 200,000 more. Abri was overthrown by rebels in 1990 and fled to Senegal. There, he lived freely and comfortably for 22 years in an upmarket suburb of Dakar. All this time, Abri's victims were working to see him pay for his crimes. And finally, on a Sunday morning in 2013, Abri was arrested. In court, the ex-despot resisted, denying any knowledge of his crimes. But in 2016, Abri was condemned in what has been called Africa's trial of the century. It was the first time an African Union-backed court convicted a former head of state for crimes against humanity. He was sentenced to life imprisonment.
Vous disposez d'un délai de 15 jours à compter de la date du prononcé.
Behind bars, Abri remained silent until the end. Those who suffered heard not a single word of contrition and received not a single cent in compensation. And so for his victims, the fight for justice continues.
Well, many of the victims who suffered from Habre's crimes say they want justice and compensation. DW's Fred Mivuni joins us from Lagos. Fred, you were in Chad in June. Can you tell us more about the stories of the people you met?
I had difficult stories, sad stories. I spoke to the victims who were, some of them who are women who were sexually abused under Hissen Abre's rule. I also spoke to a man who was tortured in prison and he was forced to dig graves for his fellow cellmates in 1980s when Hissen Abre was in power. Take a look.
Former prisoners drew the torture they suffered under Hissen Abre's rule. Krema Bayfuta was arrested in 1985 and jailed for criticizing the government.
Four years
in prison.
Parmi les,
I lived with dead bodies.
Les morts,
I was sick for 6 months
parmi,
without any maladie, treatment.
Parce que j'ai été
but the worst thing was when I and my colleagues were taken to bury the dead prisoners.
C'est que dans la journée, mes collègues et moi allons enterrer.
It's a bit of a drive. He takes me to the outskirts of the capital, N'Djamena, to the mass graves where he buried his fellow prisoners.
We
packed there.
Et puis, c'est ici
and we dug here and buried 37 bodies.
37 corps.
37 bodies in just one day. Just after Krema was released, there was a coup. The new boss was Idriss Deby.
When Habre was removed, Krema campaigned for compensation for those who had suffered. But he says President Idriss Deby was a dictator no better than Habre. For longer than 30 years, Krema has been waiting for things to change.
He had hoped Habre's conviction of crimes against humanity would help his fight for compensation.
Oui, nous avons applaudi au niveau africain.
We celebrated in Africa and the whole world when the dictator Hissen Habre was convicted. But what happened next? Until today, the Chadian government or the African Union who are responsible to pay reparations have done nothing.
Well, that's it, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for staying tuned to Amandelig Radio here at CQT 90.3. We'll be back again next week with more news and analysis from the continent of Africa. I want to thank Gwen and her interviewer, Andy Courier at the Oakland Institute. And I want to thank Bianca Mugenyi, even though I couldn't get her on live, for putting together that wonderful 20-point modest proposal for a progressive modern foreign policy. And stay tuned for Jazz Euphorium.
Sam's excited to see his favorite band play live. He's thought about it all week. He bought his ticket. He wore his band t-shirt. He went to the concert venue. He wasn't allowed inside the concert venue. He put away his band t-shirt. He threw away his ticket. And he thought about it all week.
Don't wait until it hits you. Get vaccinated. Beginning in September, you'll need a vaccination passport to enter certain public spaces. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal.
Hey, you're listening to CKUT 90.3. This is Jazz Euphorium, a little journey sojourn through the sounds of jazz music, you know? Yeah, I'm DJ MC Lewis. Demand justice, you know, make changes, DJMC. We got Cannonball Adderley coming at you. A little tune called Lisa.